This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, August 2nd, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. On July 8th, workers at the Children's Aid Society of Ottawa, or CASO, walked off the job after contract negotiations broke down with their employer over issues of funding and a strained workforce for essential childcare services. On Tuesday, OPSU CEFPO, the union representing CASO, took to X, formerly Twitter, to announce a tentative agreement had been reached with their employer. On Wednesday, it was announced the deal had been ratified. However, as Michelle Thorne, president of OPSU CEFPO Local 454 and adoption worker at CASO says, the fight is far from over. This week, Michelle joins Rabble's labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga to talk about the agreement and what's at stake for CASO workers and the children they represent. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
So hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Thank you for having me.
Just to start off, congratulations on ratifying the new agreement this week. I saw that you said that there are still workers are still facing up to 38 full-time jobs being lost. So how did we get here with the Children's Aid Society?
We have been experiencing an erosion of our workforce for years. This is not new. The funding formula across the province is outdated, very flawed, and it's based on case volumes. So if case numbers go down, we lose workers. But it's mostly tied to things like children in care and ongoing work with families where we stay long-term with them. We've really reduced that by doing some really good preventive work. We do a lot of upfront intensive work to keep kids out of care, keep them safe with their families. That causes us to lose funding. So then we lose workers because it's all just, it's funding based. Everything is, well, we don't have enough money. The government cut our funding. So out go more workers out the door. And because of the latest deficit, which is huge, it meant cutting out even more workers. And we were told along the way over the past couple of months to expect potentially 20 workers going out the door. This could be layoffs or through attrition. So if people leave, they wouldn't have to formally lay off that quite as many, but we would still be down 20 or so, right? But during mediation on Monday, we pushed to know more about, well, what's beyond year one? Because the government funding does, like I said, it keeps coming down. So we're expecting that to happen and again be told, yes, there's more workers that have to be cut. And so we were told, yeah, another 8 in each of year 2 and 3. So that and 22 for year 1, actually. So it ended up being 38, a maximum 38. And they would not give us any protection against that. That's the protection is that's the maximum. So we are facing these mass layoffs and I really fear for my colleagues. I fear for the families we try to serve because people are just, they're already crumbling. And I don't know how anyone is going to get the work done. You know, they're already trying to just get through the day and see their families and do good work. And that's already a struggle when people are on burnout, leave, people have quit altogether, gone to other sectors. So it is, it's an Ottawa CAS problem. For us, of course, but it is across the province. All CASs in Ontario face this.
Yeah, and for context, how many employees are currently at the Children's Aid Society of Ottawa?
Right now, we think there's about 300 or 310. The number dropped from even when we were in bargaining. It was about 320 a couple of months ago. So we've lost people just in the last month or so. So just over 300, I guess. And we used to have almost 450 about 10 years ago. So it has, we've seen that, like I said, an erosion and workers are struggling. They really do want to do that good preventive work. And it's an impossible situation. It really is.
Can you tell me more about some of the preventative work that you guys are doing? I know in the past there have been critiques of children's aid work and how sometimes it removes children from their families and their communities. So how has this service changed to be more preventative, as you mentioned, and just and equitable?
Yeah, you know, there's just much more intensive work to family networks together. And that doesn't have to be family, you know, by relation. That can be what we call kin, which could even be neighbors or community members or even teachers. It's anybody that has ties to the family that could provide some kind of support. And we have a lot of conferences with all of this, which we call the network, the family network or the safety network, and work on really specific plans for how they can support the caregivers, the parents, whoever the main caregiver is for the child. And, you know, it's not just, oh, I can support them. What is that support? How specific is that support? And, you know, the intent is when you have a solid plan that we walk away, we close our file. And if anything happens, if a parent has a mental health issue where they start struggling again, the network takes over. We don't have to get involved again. Child stays with the family, might be temporarily going to stay with somebody else or someone else moves in temporarily. It's not, but they're not in care, right? They're not in stranger care. We haven't had to intervene, but to do all that work and connect with the resources and stuff is really, you know, that really is intensive upfront, especially now that, you know, just resources across the, well, it's across the province, but resources in social services, health, education have been decimated by our government. So we don't even have that, like the way we used to have those same kind of resources. We're struggling to help connect family to those resources. So it's, you know, it's not a quick plan at all. It takes time and effort. And we search out people that maybe they haven't spoken to in years. Like it's how can we connect these families together and how can we keep this child or children safe with the families and so that they stay together. We do know that there are better outcomes for kids when they don't end up in care. So we do that kind of work. And it is definitely a shift from over the decades. You know, I think we can be proud of that we've done that we've realized and recognized. I don't mean me personally, but that we've recognized that is the better way to go. And like I said, this funding formula based on volume, I don't know if it ever made sense, but it certainly doesn't now. Because like I said, we don't keep as many files open. We definitely don't have as many kids in care. The number has been reduced by 30% apparently over the last 5 years. So we've really, really decreased the kids in care and kept them with these family networks.
So would it be fair to say then, in a way, by doing this preventative work, you're addressing the past critiques that have come up against children aid work, but at the same time are being punished for it by the funding formula? Would that be a fair way to kind of characterize what's going on?
That's exactly it. I've said that to many people over this strike. We are punished. We as children's aid societies are punished for doing the good work. And our government, our provincial government, has even said that it's a mandate to do preventive work, to look at to focus on a prevention model. We've been doing that for years, long before this government ever came into power. But it has to be funded. It has to be, you have to still have the funding to keep workers, to have staff. And it's the frontline workers and everybody who supports them. It's not just the workers who go out the door. It's the it's the support staff, everybody who does everything to support indirectly or directly this kind of work. But yeah, absolutely punished.
Yeah.
It's infuriating and mind-boggling that, you know, to me, it's a no-brainer. It's not even, I don't think it's a complicated concept to explain, right? Funding, we reduce numbers, funding goes down, and then we don't have enough money to hire, to keep staff, to do that other work.
How has these mass layoffs, this loss in funding, how has that affected the kids that you guys are serving? How has it manifested in their lives and in the care that you can provide for them?
Just, I mean, the fact that we went on strike alone was something that would affect our children and that we work with. We did not want to go on strike. It was a last resort. We did everything we could. We have been bargaining since November of 2023 to try to get a deal. We've had conciliation and mediation before actually walking out. We tried. We went to so many lengths because we knew it would impact our families. But we really didn't have any choice because we had no way of pushing our voice forward to be heard, to talk about what the impact was of whatever we got in bargaining. And, you know, if we lose that many workers, again, whether it's attrition or layoffs, that's that number down, the work that they would have been doing is now having to be spread out among everybody who's left behind. And like I said, they're already crumbling, and workers are crying all the time. They cry in their cars every day after trying to do something for families. There's fewer workers, and there's fewer resources for them to connect their families to. So they just are at a loss. They're at a total loss. And so the families are struggling. The resources aren't there. Even advocacy that we used to be able to do, like things, for example, like housing, a housing letter to get them into priority subsidized housing or affordable housing. There's just almost nothing there. So we can write a letter, but there's nothing for them. So it doesn't mean that they're not important, or that whoever works in these resources, it's not that they don't think it's important. They don't have anything to connect us with, right? So you've got that. And then, you know, if you're just trying to get from case to case, you're not going to be doing the solid work that you know is the right thing to do, right? You're just going to do your basic home visits and you know, just, we aren't robots. We can't just keep absorbing more and more. And, you know, doing overtime, for example, and, you know, I don't think workers begrudge doing overtime here and there, but you can't sustain constant overtime just to keep barely afloat. Workers are missing time with their own families, right? They're spending evenings out, or they're, you know, locked in their office trying to get, you know, what we used to call paperwork, but computer work done, and miss out on having time with their own kids and their own partners because they just are trying to keep up. And so that it's just not sustainable. Yeah. So kids will suffer for sure.
That's interesting to me because you mentioned that it is a mandate from the provincial government to do that preventative work. But then these cuts are happening and it's making it difficult to do that preventative work. So what rationale have you guys been receiving for why this funding is being cut, if anything?
The only things we hear are that, well, this is your budget and this is what you have to work within. And the ministry has put out public statements in recent weeks about how much funding they've given to children's aid societies, but they talk about $1.6 billion for the sector. That hasn't changed in about a decade. It might have gone up slightly, but not anywhere near what it needs to keep up with cost of living. And they'll mention, you know, we've given $14 million, I think is some number they've given. We've given $14 million or whatever numbers they keep putting out, but they might fund a certain program, like a specific program. So we've given funding to uprate, for example. We have what's called Ready, Set, Go program. It's working with our youths who are no longer in care when they hit 18. So it's that aftercare kind of support, right? To support them through independence. So they've given some funding for that. But the other funding drops because of, again, the volume. So at the end of it, we're out the money. This extra funding isn't over and above the amount we need to have a healthy staff. So it's smoke and mirrors, these numbers they keep putting out. And when they say 14 million, it's spread across, I think, 45 or something like 45 or 50 children's aid societies. So it's barely a drop in the bucket. And meanwhile, they're buying helicopters and trying to get beer in corner stores and getting out of contracts at the beer store 4 months early and spending hundreds of millions of dollars for beer. And when we're trying to protect our most vulnerable children, it's just, yeah, it's really sad. And we don't understand. But that's what the ministry comes out with. That's their whatever rationale. Like I said, we give them money and that's what they have to work with. One of the things that happened last year that really impacted not just Ottawa CAS, and this is why so many are in deficit all of a sudden, more than before. Before this, Ottawa Children's Aid was never in deficit. You know, but the care for children in private facilities, the daily rate has gone up so much. It's a rate that is negotiated between the ministry and these resources, but then we didn't get the funding to cover it. So the rates went up, you know, and we're talking thousands of dollars a day per child, for some youths, depending on how complex their needs are, $500, $1,000, $2,000 per day, but we didn't get the funding from the ministry to cover that. So that's where the sort of the big hit happened. But even with that deficit, our employer could have made a decision to still preserve its most valuable resources, its staff. It's union members who are out on the front lines, who are supporting the workers that are out on the front lines. We're really at a loss. Well, we've seen this government, what they've done, right? This is not new as far as their priorities are clearly not with people. They're not with people's health, people's education, social safety net. It's all being eroded, and we're just one more.
Yeah, and that's a really good point you make. Like, we've talked a bit about the Ottawa situation as well as the provincial situation. Can you expand a bit more on how, like, children aid societies across the province are being affected by this government and this underfunding?
Others are seeing these mass layoffs too. We've actually just had London Middlesex Children's Aid, Kawartha Halliburton, and Link, which is Chatham Kent Children's Aid, have all now announced layoffs I believe the double figures for all of them. I think 19 at Children's Aid in London. They've lost apparently their entire family visitation program. The workers who support children who are in care and help them have the visits with their parents, they've cut that whole program. So they've announced these big layoffs, and I would not be surprised to hear more to come, because that's all just in the past few months, right? We're next in the pile. But our employer has made a decision to not protect us against those cuts. And I don't know how they expect the work to get done properly when it already isn't possible to do it properly with the number of workers that we do have.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a dire situation, not just in Ottawa, but across the province, of these services being cut and understaffed and underfunded. So what's next? What is, like, the next step in fighting for these better services for the kids and also for the workers to be healthy?
Yeah, for sure. This is a continued fight. We're not giving up. We are back to work, even though this is a deal that, it is not going to protect our staff. But, you know, the sector, which is with OPSU and QP and other unions, is going to continue the fight. We've brought it way out in the open, more than ever before. The attention is now out there. So the pressure will be on. It will continue. The sector is looking at continuing a campaign to properly fund us, to stop the bleeding. You know, there's a lot to fix, but at least stop this erosion of the workforce and then figure out from there. But yes, the fight is not over. And like I said, OPSU, QP, and others are banding together to really do something to fix this, because at this rate, I don't even know how child welfare can continue to function properly and do this good work, right? And keep kids safe and keep families healthy. We can't help our families and our youth if our workforce is not healthy, if we're falling apart.
Yeah. And so how can the general public kind of support in that? Because you mentioned a bit of, like, child welfare might not be able to continue. What's at stake for the broader, you know, population of Ontario, and how can they support?
I mean, it's part of the bigger picture with what we've seen in this province, right? With, like I said, education, health. And so our entire population is at risk of all of these cuts. And so, you know, it may not affect some individuals, but it affects our society. And so everybody should be concerned about this. I think it's a no-brainer to say that people want families to be healthy. I don't think people would say, no, we don't. That's wrong. So, you know, the continued pressure on the ministry, on the Ford government, advocating even maybe with city officials, like municipalities could try, you know, could push. I mean, that's their citizens too, right? It is a provincial funded issue, but it does affect municipalities and their citizens and how healthy they are, right? And so I think that's the kind of thing people can write to their MPPs, any kind of ability they have to kind of keep making their voice known, write letters to the editor of papers, you know, those kind of things. I think anything like that, speak up at any chance they get. And we have to band together or stay banded together in order to do something about this. So hopefully we can. I think the strike did bring a lot of, brought it out into the forefront where a lot of people just didn't realize. We hear a lot about health and education, right? Teachers and nurses and how the hospitals are, the wait times, you know, we hear about all this stuff, but this is sort of a, you know, it's a small sector, right? It's not a big sector. but we do important work that's that, yeah, I think it got highlighted because as we're talking to the public, we've talked to a lot of people in the public over these past 3, 4 weeks. And when we've explained the funding for our Willow situation, they're just shocked. They're just they don't understand. And so I think if they, if that now that that awareness is out there, if people can, like I said, push their MPPs and keep up that pressure, and we hope, I guess, that we finally can get a government in power that will actually try to preserve our citizens, our kids and their families, and do right by them.
It really comes back to what you said. The fight doesn't end.
Exactly. Yeah. No, we're not going to give up. We can't, right? We as a sector, we can't give up. We got in this work because we are advocates. So we also need to advocate for our members and the families that they serve.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Rebel Radio today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate giving me this opportunity, and I hope that your listeners really can take on some of this fight with us, and we'll see how it goes.
That was Michelle Thorne, president of OPSU-CEFPO Local 454 and adoption worker at Children's Aid Society of Ottawa, in conversation with Rabble Labour reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Michelle. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories of Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, August 1st marked Emancipation Day in Canada, a day which commemorates the abolition of enslavement in 1834 in the British Empire. To mark the day, the Black Class Action Secretariat held a rally in Ottawa calling on the federal government to end anti-Black discrimination in the public service. A report written by Dr. Rachel Zellers from St. Mary's University in Halifax found that Black, Indigenous, and racialized workers at the Privy Council office were clustered into lower-level positions compared to white employees. The Privy Council office is one of the highest-level offices in the public service. In response to public pressure led in part by the Black Class Action Secretariat, the Privy Council has hired a chief diversity officer and is implementing a program designed to promote more Black and racialized employees within its department. Still, some are concerned about the timeliness of solutions implemented within the office. Staying in national news, students at Dalhousie University in Halifax continue to defiantly protest their school's support of Israel. For nearly 80 days, students have been encamped on university grounds, calling for the school to disclose and divest from their investments and partnerships with the State of Israel and the organizations that support it. Dalhousie is just one school of many across North America that saw similar protests in the wake of Israel's ongoing assault against the Palestinian people. Some schools have displaced protesting students, like in Ottawa and Toronto, without negotiating in good faith. Other schools like Windsor have successfully reached agreements with the protesters. For their part, the students protesting at Dalhousie remain undeterred. In labor news, Ontario labor organizations, including Unifor Ontario and the Ontario branch of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, released a letter last week opposing the expansion of for-profit childcare services. An open letter, which was signed by a further 140 labor and childcare organizations, argued that the expansion of for-profit services would come at the expense of publicly funded childcare centers, which are a part of a federal program that guarantees $10 a day childcare. The letter reads in part, quote, "Nonprofit childcare providers, which include Indigenous-led Francophone cooperatives and those supporting children with disabilities, are ready and willing to work alongside the government to expand their services," end quote. The letter was sent to the Ontario Minister of Childcare Services, Todd Smith, as well as the Association of Ontario Municipalities. In environmental news, the extreme wildfire in Jasper National Park, Alberta, is highlighting the need for a national wildfire prevention program. Last week, a wildfire destroyed over 30,000 hectares of the beautiful national park. Sadly, it also burned 30% of the town of Jasper itself. Many historic buildings in the town were lost. Edward Struzik, a fellow at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University, stated that Jasper wildfire reinforced the need for a national wildfire strategy. Struzik pointed out that wildfires are an important Indigenous issue. While the Indigenous population living in Canada amounts to about 5% of the total population, their communities make up 42% of all communities that have been evacuated due to wildfires in 2023. Earlier this year, the Alberta Union of Public Employees criticized the Alberta government for failing to adequately fund public wildfire response services. As of this week, there are 117 wildfires currently active in Alberta, with 23 of those classified as being out of control. And finally, staying in environmental news, David Suzuki is warning about the risks of disposing and storing nuclear waste. While nuclear power can be efficient, the waste it creates represents a problem for the environment as well as public health. Moreover, the mining and distilling of nuclear materials to power nuclear plants creates ecological damage. Nuclear Waste Management Organization, a non-profit corporation representing nuclear power companies, has identified Ignis and South Bruce, Ontario, as potential sites for disposing of 6 million bundles of highly radioactive waste in a deep geological repository. The federal government has agreed to the organization's plans. Indigenous communities in the area are objecting to the plan, stating that they had not been properly consulted. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
In 2024, many indie news media organizations are making the hard decision to close up shop. But with your support, Rabble.ca can continue to share news for the rest of us for years to come. Support Rabble during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation. It's never too late to become a Rabble Rouser.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and now on YouTube. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your local radio station? It's easy. For more information, get in touch with me, Brianne Doyle, at brianne@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.